individuals threw down the gauntlet at the Housing Opportunities Commission, known as HOC. These four individuals, including myself, were arrested at the HOC to bring attention to HOC's continued desecration of the Moses African Cemetery in Bethesda. These individuals are now known as the HOC 4. You're going to hear from these individuals, the HOC 4. What triggered their decision to risk it all? Arrests, fines, and possible incarceration. If you've had experience with HOC, Section 8 housing, and would like to share your experiences, please call us at 202-588-0893. Good morning, Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. I'm Marcia Coleman Adebayo, and I'm with you the fourth Wednesday of every month. For 2 years, activists, both religious and secular, have met at the Housing Opportunities Commission, HOC, in Kensington, Maryland, to protest that agency's decision to purchase an African burial ground that lies underneath a parking lot. There's now evidence that before emancipation, plantation owners, I prefer to call them what they were, terrorists, used this plot of land to dump the bodies of kidnapped West and Central African citizens who died as a result of the barbarism of American slavery. After emancipation, a black fraternal organization called White's Tabernacle No. 39 purchased the land in Bethesda on River Road near Whole Foods and called it the Ancient Order of the Sons and Daughters, Brothers and Sisters of Moses. It was a cemetery that was born in love. But not even the cemetery was immune from the savagery of white supremacy. County officials, in collusion with white businesses, successfully stole every black home in Bethesda on River Road through bureaucratic and political tactics. After they stole the homes of the African American community, they decided to desecrate Moses Cemetery. Businesses in collusion with local government paved over Moses Cemetery and turned it into a parking lot. Future generations were never supposed to know that a prosperous black community once existed in Bethesda after emancipation, and certainly they were not to know the brutal way that white supremacy disenfranchised this community in the 50s and 60s. Every government agency, until the recently elected county executive Mark Elrich, participated in a cover-up and outright lies about the existence of the black community on River Road and its beloved Moses Cemetery. So that brings us to the present. As mentioned, for 2 years, activists have protested at the HOC. We've been met with disrespect, dishonor, and indifference. The three that you're about to meet decided that enough is enough. We participated in civil disobedience at the last HOC meeting, and were arrested. From my perspective, it's time to let our ancestors rest. They were treated like animals while they were alive, and now they're treated like trash. I'm pleased to introduce you to my fellow arrestees, the HOC 4. Dr. Tim Willard. Tim holds a PhD in history and worked for 26 years at the National Archives. He retired to take care of his grandson, who's now 7 years old. He's been active in the Green Party for 2 decades and ran for Montgomery County Council at large 2 times. Mary Rooker, former Montgomery County Green Party co-chair, has been an activist on a range of social justice issues since the 1970s. Her primary advocacy these days is electoral reform, especially ranked choice voting, a simple, no-cost measure that ends lesser evil voting. And Lynn Pekkanen. She worked for Senator Ben Cardin while he was a congressman, and she worked at the Department of Justice on police training and anti-discrimination law. She loves being an activist in Montgomery County. If you'd like to participate in this conversation, please call 202-588-0893. Tim, Mary, and Lynn, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Hi, Lynn. Can you hear us?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, good to hear you this morning.
Good morning to you.
Why don't we just jump into this conversation? Why don't we start with you, Tim? You have been going down to HOC almost for a couple years now. Mm-hmm. And so why did you get involved with the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition and the fight to stop the desecration of Moses Cemetery?
Well, I originally attended a meeting at the Macedonia Baptist Church about the efforts to memorialize Moses Cemetery, and which is now, you know, under a parking lot. And I was just horrified by the desecration of this holy land. And so I felt it was important to step up and work to right this wrong. And also, a big part of the problem is just the unresponsive nature of Montgomery County bureaucracy, particularly the HOC. We needed to do something to make our voices heard and to get a solution to this problem.
Thank you. Mary?
Oh, I completely agree. I know Tim and Marcia and Lynn, you've been more active on this longer than I have. I've been watching and following the news and just realized something's got to give here, mm-hmm. and nothing is. Mm-hmm. And I know that direct action often gets results where trying to play within the system by the rules doesn't always work.
Right, exactly. And Lynn?
The story of what's happened to the community and the cemetery is something that reverberates in the hearts of anyone who hears it. Even children, when hearing this story, say, this is wrong. So when I heard what was going on, I had to join in those who were looking for justice here.
Right. There's something just evil. I mean, literally, you know, when you talk about clear demarcations between good and evil, there's just something evil right. about erasing a community's history. And then once you disenfranchise a community by taking their land away from them. I mean, these were people who literally came out of, you know, what European historians like to call slavery. But it really wasn't slavery. This is more barbarism than it was what we currently think of in terms of Roman slavery or what was happening in Africa, which is more like indentured servitude, where people would come and pay off debts for a couple of years and then go back home or marry even into the family that they were working for. In America, this was literally barbarism, you know, where people were being murdered and raped and cut into little pieces and there was no way of getting out of escaping. So that was really not what we typically think of as slavery. In terms of a classic definition of slavery. And so these people somehow survive this barbarism and then try to build their lives again. And 3 years after this barbarism, they're actually landowners. This black community, African community, they're actually landowners on River Road. And then they're building their lives. They're building a community. They've got a church. They've got schools. They've got a life. And then all of a sudden, there's this collusion between government and businesses. And they decide, what are these black folks doing on our land? This is important land in Bethesda now. It was swamp land when the black folks took it over right after emancipation, but now they've built it up and it's a thriving community and people can see that this is a community, this is land that's worth having now. And they decide, you don't have a right anymore to work and live and breathe on this land. And they literally steal every single home. And then after they steal every home, then they set in on the cemetery and they say, you don't have a right even to lie in the earth anymore. And they literally just tear down every single tombstone. And then they put a parking lot on there. I mean, there's just something evil about that. I mean, for human beings to be so intentional about destroying people, it's very evil.
And it's become almost Kafkaesque.
Right.
Because it was not just the original evil that was done, but now we're fighting this totally unresponsive bureaucracy
that refuses
to admit first that the situation existed,
right,
and now that they can do anything about it, that they're just not going to talk to us,
right. And now, thank goodness, we do have a county executive, Mark Elrich, who is talking to us. But obviously, before that time, we had a county executive who was calling the police on us. Mary?
Well, you know, we talk about how in a racist culture like ours, it's a crime to be breathing while black. But apparently, even after you stop breathing, you're still going to be subjected to terrorism.
Right.
I mean, this is insane.
Right, right. I agree with you. That's an incredible metaphor, that even when you're not breathing, you're still subject to white supremacy. What is it about the desecration of Moses that struck your emotional and political core and triggered this decision out of so many other issues that you could have gotten arrested for, or Tim, you could be engaged in? What was it that struck you so much about this issue at your very core that you decided to take this action?
Well, to begin with, the Green Party has four key values. You know, we're not just an environmentalist party. Social justice is a core value for this. And, you know, I just don't think it's possible to build a society that's ecologically sustainable if there is no social justice.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, Martin Luther King said it best when he said that an injustice in one place is a threat to justice everywhere. And we really believe that. So when this issue came up, and it was so obviously a case of long, long overdue need for justice, it's just something we had to get involved with.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, what are you thinking?
I think one of the greatest evils of this situation, and illustrated so well here at the cemetery, is that in order for terrorist slavery to thrive, white people had to be convinced that black human beings were not human beings. And to this day, disdain and separateness persists in the minds of white Americans. They cloak it by saying the activist group at the cemetery is rude. They're so loud. No one wants to talk to them. Mm. It's disdain. It's looking at one set of human beings as other and less than us, than we are. And that harms both groups so deeply.
Mm. Very well said. Mary?
Well, generally, what motivated me in a big picture way is the understanding that third parties and independent movements completely independent of either of the two ruling parties, is where change happens. It doesn't happen within the system. When it does, it's decades later, a day late and a dollar short.
Mm-hmm.
Or I guess these days it would be decades later and $1 trillion short. But so I understand that real change only comes from people getting out there and I don't want to say confronting the system when it doesn't respond, because I don't want to sound combative. I'm very much into nonviolence. That's one of the other Green Party's main principles. But why this particular issue? It's just heartbreaking. I can't think of any. It's not that other issues aren't, but this one just touched me in such a way. How dare anybody treat these ancestors that way?
Right.
How
right.
dare they?
Right.
Good heavens. It's just sacrilege.
There's just something that is just unseemly, despicable about this. So as a part of this whole struggle, what has been very interesting, intriguing to me is how the system sort of reaches out to other branches of, you know, what I would consider like-minded individuals. And they actually do find these people. I mean, you know, when you talk about what happened to King and Selma, Birmingham, there was a whole, you know, infrastructure around white supremacy. They had the judges, they had the lawyers, they had the policemen, they had the Klan, they had all kinds of infrastructure that supported the underbelly of white supremacy. And what we see as well with the HLC is their underbelly, because now they've reached out to quote unquote historians and people who can justify what they're doing. And every time we go to HLC, they like to quote a particular historian who somehow they think supports their position. And so they're now creating this infrastructure that supports them. And Tim, you have a PhD in history. So I was wondering if you could help us, because a lot of people, when HLC sends information out about this issue, they're always quoting their historian about what really happened on River Road. And according to their historian, the black community in Washington was very separate than the black community in Bethesda and the black community in Potomac, like around Scotland or these other black communities, and they didn't communicate with each other. They just sort of huddled in their own little enclaves. Well, we know that that's not true, because black people were constantly in flux. They were constantly migrating. They were communicating. They were trying to figure out how to survive white supremacy. But nevertheless, that's their own particular kind of reformist history. So maybe you could enter here as a historian and just help us understand a little bit about what are they doing by bringing in "quote unquote," their historian to try to combat to counter our narrative.
It's the HSC has posted this 100-page document that's supposedly a history of the cemetery, but it's a deeply flawed piece of work. The basic thrust of it is that the cemetery was strictly a DC institution. And the Macedonia Baptist Church had never had anything to do with it. But as Marcia says, there was no distinction between the D.C. community and the River Road community. I mean, this was a segregated time. It was a time of profound racism. So these communities banded together of necessity and formed their own institutions and worked together. Even beyond that, we have good evidence that this land was used as a burial ground for slaves before the Civil War, when this was a plantation.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of evidence linking the two communities together. The pastor of the Rock Creek Baptist Church in D.C. actually lived in Bethesda. And lived right adjacent to the cemetery, and he helped the Macedonia Baptist Church get its first building, which was located right next to the cemetery. And when gentrification forced the Rock Creek Baptist Church to move, many of the parishioners in that church ended up coming to River Road, and River Road, the Macedonia Baptist Church, became, for some of them, their new church. So there was a direct connection there.
Okay.
So there's an awful lot of evidence. It's just impossible to ignore the evidence that these two communities were so closely connected. And that right now the Macedonia Baptist Church is the only surviving institution that goes back to this, connected to the cemetery.
Right, exactly. And there was a lot of. Oh yes, we have a caller on the line. Hi, good morning. This is Marcia Coleman out of Bio. What's at stake?
Yes, good morning. Let me turn down my radio.
Sure.
Thank you for taking my call. I just, every time I hear this story, it gets my blood pumping because it reminds me very much of the Lower Manhattan African burial ground,
right,
where 416 people of African descent were reinterred, which there could have been 10,000 buried.
Right.
It refuted the presence of slavery in the upper colonies.
Right.
And it, I've got to say that in the 1700s, it was mapped out as an African burial ground,
mm-hmm,
and then it became a trash dump.
Right.
And I have to say that those layers and layers of trash protected the site. So then when they started building buildings and parking lots and everything on top of it, when they dug deep to make a new building, that's when they found the gravesite.
Wow.
So it hurts me because we see that this is repeated all throughout our country. It is, you will find burial sites and colonies and people living near water. It is, it makes sense. And if we told our children and ourselves to study more anthropology and history and development, we would understand where we are buried and where our communities existed before they were paved over.
Right. That's such an important point. I mean, what is it that we learn from these communities? What is it that we learn from, for example, the community on River Road, that my children's generation, for example, didn't learn because Montgomery County has spent so much time bearing over and basically denying that they existed?
All it takes is one generation of forgetting.
Yes.
To disappear.
Exactly. That's the erasure.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your call.
Thank you. Bye.
I believe we have another caller on the line.
He wanted me to relay a question to you. He was interested in clarifying the role of the HOC in the in the desecration of the cemetery in Bethesda.
Sure. the HOC is the property owner of the burial ground in Bethesda, Maryland. So that is the reason why we go to HOC every month, because they own the property. And they initially denied that the grave sites were there. But now Montgomery County, now Moses Cemetery is actually listed in the burial sites of Montgomery County. So now it's official. But now they're basically saying that, they are content with leaving the parking lot on top of the burial ground without a proper memorialization. So they consider the parking lot to be a proper memorialization for these very, very brave and incredible people who survived so much in this country. I do want to get to the arrests, because I think that is an important step for any human being to make. This is, you know, we've just celebrated the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And after they pleaded and prayed and did so many things and realized that it wasn't going to be enough, then they went into direct, nonviolent action, through arrests. We often forget too that even school children were arrested during the civil rights movement. So this was a tactic that was used not only by Dr. King, but through almost every sector of our community. And Tim and Mary and Lynn, you also crossed that line. You made the decision to get arrested on January 9th at the HOC. can you explain why? What was your thinking? Maybe, Lynn, let's start with you. What was your thinking when you made the decision that you were prepared to face 60 days incarceration and a $500 fine for protesting at the HLC? What were you thinking? Why did you do it?
The HLC had raised the us to this point, and to this day, HLC on their website lies, saying that no one was arrested. It's unbelievable, the lies that they put out. I felt it was necessary to take a tiny bit of the risk that the followers of Martin Luther King took. If you look at the pictures of the faces of those nonviolent, peaceful protesters, they were terrified, and rightly so. And they still stepped forward and took the risk. And the risk is so much less for me. Only 60 days in jail, not massive injury and who knows what other kind of retaliation. So it's a step for justice that just needed to be taken. We were at that point.
Right. Mary?
Well, I agree. You know, Dr. King also talked about there are competing laws, and when the laws that the system is following are immoral, we have a moral obligation to correct those laws. We just can't sit idly by.
Right. Tim?
Well, you know, I agree with everything that Mary and Lynn have said, but also there was sort of a trigger last fall. The coalition had had a very successful meeting with the Regency Group, which is going to be developing the land, and we were sort of expecting that after that meeting we would have a three-way meeting with Regency and HOC and the coalition, but HOC abruptly shut us down completely. It would not even talk to us, and in the last couple of months they've been telling us they will never talk to us. And so it just reached a point where, you know, we had to take it to another level or we were just going to get blown off. And so I think if they may have thought that they were just going to get away with it that way, and we had to show them that we're just not going to go away, and we are going to do whatever it takes to get a resolution to this.
I just want to add one more thing. You know, I really knew that an arrest was possible if somebody was engaging in civil disobedience because of the prior Housing Opportunities Commission meeting. But I did not plan to do civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. I was really just going to go. I needed to be a presence. I needed to show my face
right.
to these commissioners. And I had no intention of risking arrest. But when the moment came, you know, when you're not sitting at home,
right.
when you're there, it's really hard
right.
to just sit by while this is happening,
right.
while this terrorism is going on right in front of you.
Right.
And I changed my mind while I was sitting there. I couldn't stand it anymore.
Well, I must tell you that I felt the same way. I'm not sure that I went there to get arrested. I knew that there was a possibility I might get arrested, of course, but because they had called the police the last time, and the police always follows me around at these demonstrations. But I didn't go there specifically to get arrested. But, you know, we had one idea, which was to bring in basically a auction block and to talk about how many times these people have been sold. Because since I've been engaged in this process, they've been sold three times. They were sold by Equity One. They were sold by the Regency Centers. And then they were sold to HLC. And I remember mounting the auction block. And then just something just came over me. It was almost like a DNA memory flashback of my relatives standing on that auction block. And for a minute, I literally almost lost consciousness. I was like back in Dublin, Georgia, which is where my family is from. And I'm on this block and it occurred to me just how despicable these people were and just how cruel it is to continue to sell people even after they're dead. And then I thought about my son who'd been, you know, stopped by police 30 times and how this is just, it's not stopping. And so when it was time to remain silent, like yourselves, I just simply couldn't do it I couldn't do it anymore. It would have been more difficult for me not to get arrested than to get arrested at that point. Because I was so angry just historically about what people have suffered. Let's talk for a minute. I think we have about 1 minute left about follow-up. Where is the follow-up? What, now we're going to go back to HOC the first Wednesday, in February. Please, all of our members, please meet us there at 3:30. We march in at 4 o'clock at the HOC in Kensington, Maryland. So what about the follow-up? What's happening?
Well, I would say the first thing is to contact your county council representatives to support, asking them to support MC 7-19. That's the bill that gives the Inspector General oversight of the Housing Opportunities Commission. And specifically, if you're in County Council Reps Craig Rice, or, well, actually Hans Reimer, I believe, is at large, so everybody can contact Hans. But contact Craig Rice and Hans Reimer on the council. They were the ones who were not coming forward to really strongly support this bill, and so we want to let them know that we need their support. And that's primarily because our legislators in Annapolis who are looking at this bill now will look back at the county council. Did they support it? So we need to show that there was a solid wall of support. This Friday at 9 or 9:30 also in Annapolis, the full Montgomery County delegation will probably vote on this bill, MC 719, and we want to make sure that happens.
Okay, well, we're out of time. So I think the next time we'll talk, I'd love to have you come back and talk about the Green Party and to talk about the work that you're doing in the Washington, D.C. area. But I think that's going to be it for today. So Mary, Tim, and Lynn, thank you so much for being on the program. We have to end the discussion right now, but I look forward to reporting on the next steps of this struggle, including a trial date and possibly a hearing. We hope our community obviously will come out the first Wednesday of February to HOC in Kensington and support this effort. Let's take a break now and learn for you to learn how you can participate in community activities.
Hi, I'm Robin Carver, and this is your WPFW Social Justice Calendar for the Washington metro area. Sunday, January 20th, the Jelani Initiation Program will hold a launch meeting for its Manhood Training Initiative for Teenagers, featuring insights on self-knowledge, life skills, African history, science, business, self-discipline, and communication skills, 2 to 3 p.m. at the Petworth Library, 4200 Kansas Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C. For more information, call 202-669-4724 or send email to ojelani787@gmail.com. Also, Sunday, January 20th, the Davies Concert Series will hold a benefit concert for the Coalition for African Americans in the Performing Arts, Figaro Meets Frederick Douglass, featuring fine musical artists from CAAPA, free and open to all. Donations given at the door will be passed to CAAPA, 4 p.m. at the Davies Memorial Unitarian Universalist Church, 7400 Temple Hill Road, Camp Springs, Maryland. For more information, visit the Davies Concert Series page on Facebook or call 301-627-0284. Monday, January 1st, Anacostia Riverkeeper will hold a collaborative trash cleanup to celebrate the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the memory of Joseph Glover, founder and chair of the Pope Branch Park Restoration Alliance, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Pope Branch Park, 2900 M Place Southeast. For more information, send email to info@anacostiariverkeeper.org. For an online listing of these events, or if you'd like your social justice event included in the social justice calendar, visit the webpage ips-dc.org/social-justice-calendar, where you will find submission guidelines. The Social Justice Calendar is a public service brought to you by the Institute for Policy Studies in partnership with WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for coming back. That was the Scotland AME Zion Choir singing, "I'm Gonna Put On My Robe and Tell the Story of How I Made It Over." Welcome back. My name is Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo. You may recall that last November, 2018, we had a group of American University graduate students on What's at Stake to discuss their research on three historically black communities in Maryland: Bethesda, Macedonia River Road, Tobytown in Potomac, and the Scotland community in Potomac. These communities were established after emancipation. Today, we will continue our discussion with three American University graduate students. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, please call us at 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. Today, we're joined by Delon Justeville, Helen Bush, and Paige McGrugan. Welcome to What's at Stake.
Thank you so much for having
Thank
us.
You.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I know it's early in the morning. Today, we're going to focus on Scotland, on the Scotland community. And are we going to focus mainly on the church or the community itself?
More so the church and its history of activism and how that has continued on into the community.
Great, thank you. And I think we're going to talk about the resistance of Absolutely. This community to erasure, mm-hmm. to just being erased from history. So, Helen, why don't you tell us a little bit about the history of Scotland, of the black community in Scotland, Potomac?
Of course. So according to records in the Montgomery Historical Society, Scotland was founded by five families of freed slaves in the 1880s. William Dove was who bought the first lot, about 36 and a quarter acres, for $210 in 1880, so that's 17 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, and then other families followed. And many of the descendants of those families, Dove and Mason, for example, stayed in the area and are still around or still have ties to Scotland, particularly to the AME Zion Church that's on Seven Locks Road. And fast forward a couple decades, for the sake of time, Scotland was originally a much more rural community. And after World War II, you have suburban creep. So you have housing developments of mostly white, economically affluent neighborhoods coming in. And by the 1950s, 1960s, the housing conditions in Scotland were not great.
And when you said that they weren't great, what does that mean?
I would say reports talk about being dilapidated, and there was some discussion of housing properties being condemned due to sanitary issues and water conditions.
So that meant, was there indoor plumbing?
Indoor plumbing for most of the houses there. There was also not a paved road. So once you got onto Seven Locks Road, that was partially paved, and so there were transportation issues as well.
Wow. We have a clip from one of Scotland's most respected members, Miss Barbara Smith. You conducted this research, is that right?
Myself and then Paige also.
And Paige. Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you.
I used to pray that we would get some decent houses in Scotland and everything. And then all of a sudden, here it is. And I'm still praying for it, and it's on the way in, you know. It was so funny. I said, you know, I've been praying for this all my life.
Wow. Would you like to add to that? What was the discussion around? Can you put this in context?
Sure. So Paige actually did an oral history for one of our classes with Miss Barbara, and she was talking about how she had always wanted to have decent housing in Scotland because she was a girl during the Great Depression, so 1930s, and then into the 1940s, and she had been praying and hoping for better housing conditions, and even though her prayers were answered with good housing, eventually the community had to fight initially in order to get decent housing and to keep their property from being condemned and not having it being sold to developers.
Well, Paige?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so Miss Barbara talked a lot about how much she valued the new housing that was able to go up in the new construction after the Save Our or during and after the Save Our Scotland initiative, formed in 1965 to fight for to make sure that they would be able to get quality housing from the county. And the houses were started construction soon after that, and construction was finished by the early 70s. And that improved the living conditions, education, and that prevented the Montgomery County Planning Board from buying Scotland property. And Ms. Barbara had offered more insight into the movement during our interview.
So she said, I used to pray all the every night. I used to pray that we'd get some decent housing in Scotland. Now, this is in Potomac, Maryland. And what sort of jumps out at me initially is the fact that they were able to buy this property, what, 13 years after emancipation? Was it 13?
I think 17 years.
17 years after emancipation. Where did they find the money to buy? I mean, $210 was a lot of money in the late 1800s. Where did they find? Was it through farming or how did they?
Well, it was interesting because I was looking at some of the records in the Montgomery Historical Society and what they had met. There was a report that had been written, and what it seemed to imply was the land that Scotland was originally a part of was from an older farming family, white family, and the descendants of the original owner could not agree how to divide it, so they ended up auctioning off that land. And the report seemed to imply that William Dove was able to buy the land and because they had given him some of the less desirable portions.
So very much like the Macedonia River Road, that these people were basically put on land that no one else wanted, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they were sort of segregated and just sort of... but nevertheless, it's impressive that they were able to raise $210 in the late 1800s. Can we go to the second clip, please? From the oral history.
It all started out with Save Our Scotland, SOS. We had a lady named Miss Geneva Mason that lived in the community. She was one of the leaders, too. And we had another lady named Joyce Siegel. And she was Jewish, and she one got us rolling into getting Scotland done. And I think the minister that was helping, he passed because he lived right off of Georgetown Road.
So, Paige, what were some of your initial thoughts or what did you notice during your oral history interview with Miss Barbara?
The first thing I noticed during the interview was the wealth of information and memories about the community that she has. I felt like I learned a lot from her stories. She has lived in the community and attended the church her entire life, and she has taken on some church leadership roles. She is a member of the church choir, which she joined when she was 7 years old. Mm. So her knowledge and experience is invaluable to the community and the congregation. It was really clear during the interview that she deeply loves and values Scotland. I also noticed her positive spirit and tremendous resilience. Several of the stories she told me involved very challenging situations, both in her life and in the community more generally. But through it all, she never gave up, and she was invariably able to find the humor in these situations. We both laughed quite a bit during this interview. She may be one of the most resilient people I've ever met.
And that's saying a lot, considering that this is what you do. I mean, you're an anthropologist, and you're involved in oral history. Why don't we turn to Delon? So we've just heard that Scotland AME Zion Church has been central, has played a major role in Montgomery County, especially in terms of community development, organizing, and resilience against the encroachment of development or gentrification, white supremacy. In what way do you see, or what ways do you see Scotland continuing on this important legacy? Most people don't think of a black community in Potomac, mm-hmm. but that's what we're looking at. It's a historically black community
Absolutely.
In the heart of one of the wealthiest communities in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your perspective on that?
So honestly, what I've learned from my time at Scotland, I would go as far to say as the church, the clergy and its congregation, it's not necessarily a continuation of this legacy, because this is something that I've noticed is really woven into the very fabric of Scotland. So by that I mean there, I'm always worried of phrasing the ways black communities operate around resistance. Like, I don't want to pitch them as always having to fight back against. That's why I love this word resilience so much. We're not just fighting back, but there's a thriving that's beyond surviving. They're always able to rise up and above the conditions that they were put under. And at Scotland, they're built on this foundation of kinship, and the ways that the church has nurtured its surrounding community is simply a direct reflection of how this congregation has, for a long time now, built its own membership through faith, family, and fellowship.
And what's interesting also about Scotland and all these communities up and down Bethesda and Potomac is that you have all these marriages. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a mom who comes from the Scotland community, mm-hmm. a dad who comes from Tobytown in Potomac,
right.
And then they'll send their kid to Macedonia for Sunday school. So you have this interwoven relationship.
Right.
And then, of course, you've got kids going to Tinley Town, and particularly during the period of segregation. So you've got this interwoven, interconnected community. And, of course, they had baseball games together. They rotated in terms of going to singing conventions together. And like I said, they were married. There were marriages which cemented these kinds of relationships. But I'd like for you, Delon, just to explore this issue a little bit more with us between resistance and resilience. Because I think that's a fascinating concept. Because in sort of African American or African, I was going to say epistemology, but in terms of the way we look at these struggles, we're always looking at them as struggle,
mm-hmm.
which is the resistance part,
yes.
Right? But, you know, what you get, and I've gone to Scotland now 2 or 3 times, is the resilience of that community.
Right, right.
They are still there in Potomac, right off of Seven Locks Road, mm-hmm. which is, I've said, one of the best choirs in the area.
Mind-blowing
choir, actually. Mm-hmm. So if you could just explore that, what's in your head when you're looking at that dichotomy between resilience and resistance? What are you thinking?
Sure. So in my own research, I think through black remains and reproductions, both in the ways that that black communities get left out of narratives, institutions, and how we can think through the ways that black communities continue to reduce their own ways of their own cultural ways. So through my research, I notice a lot of the ways black communities are spoken about are always through combating oppression. And it's not that those histories are untrue, but I'm trying to think through, and I'm trying to invite all of folks listening and beyond to think through the ways black communities thrive and exist on their own accord. Like you mentioned, this familial structure that exists beyond the walls of the church has really been an amazing way for the communities along, like the River Road corridor up the Potomac River, to really take an unfortunate situation with the land they were given and become landowners, become entrepreneurs, become financial centers who can then contribute to the building of the Freedmen's Hospital or to the rebuilding of churches and community spaces.
Suburban Hospital.
Yes.
Right, exactly. And when we talk about that extension again, in terms of resilience, family, faith, fellowship, So we have these three F's, right? Mm-hmm. That you see that there's this connection. And, you know, maybe we could just sort of think about how Helen and Paige and Delon, I mean, how has this worked as a structure now to help this community survive the worst that humanity could throw at them, right?
Right, right.
I mean, you know, when you kidnap people, you bring them to the country, you know, ravish them, you destroy their culture, their names, everything that you can think of that makes a human being a human being, mm-hmm. is destroyed. And then one day, 1865, emancipation.
Right.
And then, as you just told us, what, 7 years later, they're landowners. So how did this family, faith, and fellowship, how did these three structures move into this equation so that this community was able to survive?
Right. Well, at least for me, with my brief but beautiful times at Scotland so far, I've seen the ways that the congregation operates not only as a family but for family. When members are experiencing any sort of trial or tribulation, a pastor board is able to address them by name and by circumstance when calling on the congregation to hold them in prayer. You see youth taking on nominal roles throughout the service, whether intervening through performance. There was an amazing liturgical dance group when I was at the homecoming service that I just can't stop thinking about, or praising through the choir, or even blessing the entire congregation through benedictions, all of which draw ties back to the ways they teach folks the responsibility both inside and outside of the home. When I think of family, it's not just, you know, biological family, but really thinking of the structures of your community through a politics of care. And that is what really fuels that resilience in my mind. You know,
The politics of care. Very interesting. Helen?
I would say also that one of the things that really impressed me and going to Scotland is you see all of the historic ties. And because the community has been around for so long, I believe the church has been there since 1925, give or take a year. And so you have a lot of the original descendants still there, and then they're very welcoming to other community members. So they're creating that kind of politics of care that Delon mentioned, and that really creates a source of strength for the current community and for the younger generations as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
And I would add on to that, I have noticed the few times that I've been in Sunday service, there really is an emphasis on making the young people and the children feel comfortable and welcome in the service.
Right.
Like Pastor Borders has mentioned several times, you know, I'm not worried about, you know, young children crying in church. Like, and I'm, you know, I don't expect them to be totally silent, because the important thing is that they're here, mm-hmm. and they're in the right place, and that's where they should be. So that, I think, really, when you have that type of attitude toward children and young people, that really helps the church keep going and thrive.
Now, Scotland is somewhat isolated, I'm not sure if you agree with me. It's not like Macedonia, which is in like the heart of Bethesda. Mm-hmm. This is sort of you could miss the Scotland community unless you know what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because you're going down Seven Locks Road towards Potomac, and then the Scotland community is sort of over to the left when you see this like little white, beautiful white church. Mm-hmm. How has their isolation from the general sort of, you know, larger scale cities like downtown Potomac or downtown Bethesda, how has that helped them survive?
Well, one way we can think about this, the benefits of this isolation is through who then Scotland is visible to. Though one might say they're not central to Potomac, but in thinking of the legacy of Black communities throughout Montgomery County and beyond, Scotland is central to them and has continued to be. So that may be an invisibility to folks who aren't looking into this Black community, but a visibility to the folks within it is one benefit I could think through.
Paige?
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I would also say, I think probably it's out of the way location, and also the fact that the church itself is a historic place, is on the Register of Historic Places, probably helps keep things going a little bit. And the fact that the Scotland community is right up the hill, and it's a very nice place to live now, and it's close by.
Right, Helen?
Yeah, I would say going off of what Delon mentioned too, it's Scotland is visible to its own community members and also to those in Macedonia and in Tobytown and along these other historically Black communities in the River Road area. That's really who they're visible to, and that also creates that sense of intergenerational community across towns.
Right. Now, today at, is it 5 o'clock, we're going to have a program at the American University's archives?
Yes, today at 5:30.
Could you tell us a little bit? We only have 1 minute left, but could you tell us a little bit about that program?
Okay, I'll try my best. So one of the, what we're hoping this collaboration will result in is to develop a way of maintaining these histories for these future generations we just mentioned. And so today at 5:30, we will have an open house at the University Archives, who have just dedicated an entire section to what we're calling the Historic African River Road Collection, where we'll begin to not only house archival materials and oral histories from the community, but use these resources, these institutional resources, to then train and help community members to take on that maintenance of legacy themselves. So we're hoping that we have a good turnout.
Wow. Well, we're asking everyone to please come out today at 5:30.
At 5:30.
American University, what's the address?
It's the Spring Valley.
It's the Spring Valley campus.
The Spring Valley campus, yes, thank
you. American University. It used to be the American University School of Law,
yep.
But now it's a part of the archives. The archives are located in this building.
Correct.
Spring Valley, Washington, D.C. Please all come out at 5:30, and you'll hear more about the archives, or the River Road Archives. And I'd like just to thank you guys. I'm hoping that we do a lot of programs on this. The community is clearly so interested in understanding more about these communities. Mm-hmm. And so we thank you so much for everything you're doing to bring the contributions of these of this community to life. So I think we have to end there. So I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Tim Willard, Miss Mary Ruker, Lynn Pekkanen. I'd like to thank the American University students who also acted as producers for this segment. Delon Justaville, Paige McGrogan, and Helen Bush. I'd like to thank all of you for tuning in today and listening to the program. We'd like to thank our engineer, Chris BD. We'd like to thank our executive producer, Verna Avery Brown, and program director, Katia Stitt. I am Marcia Coleman Adebayo. Passionately fight for justice with no fear. Up next, Woke and Stay Woke with Dr. Faye Williams.